What happens if you tell people, you go to a party and you tell people what you do, how do they react?
So you'll get those that are really interested in it and will want to know more. And then you'll get others that eyes will go like saucers and they'll suck their teeth in and go, okay, and then change the subject or walk away. Yeah. There's no middle, no middle at all. If they do talk about it, their answer straight away is, I couldn't do that. That must be a really sad job to do. Why do you do it? And it's like, no, it's a really happy job. And then they're like, well, you're a freak because you really like death. And it's like, no, I can handle it. It's normal. It's part of life. It's no different to the midwife bringing somebody in. We are the death doula taking somebody and journeying with them on their way out.
I'm Georgie Vesti and you're listening to Dead Honest, a podcast where we talk honestly about death. Now this week it's the turn of Lizzie Neville, who you were just hearing. She's a death doula, which is a bit like being a midwife for the dying. She just loves dying people. And not in a worthy, hand-holdy, patronising, there sort of a way, but in a really proper, this is the biggest journey of your life, and I'm so pleased to be sharing it with you. We start by discussing what skills you need to be a death doula.
It's a bit of all sorts. I think you need to be called to this role. I don't think you can learn it, because it doesn't come from the head. It comes from here, your soul, your heart. You've got to be able to deal with people's emotions, and they may range from being really sad to being really angry. Doulas are very grounded people, very grounded. So I always sort of imagine it as sort of like there's a hurricane coming through that family and it's ripping everything apart. But the one person that's going to stand still and not move and be constant is that death doula. And I think for yourself, you've got to be very comfortable with death and dying.
How did you get so comfortable?
I was with a friend who was dying and it just felt comfortable talking to her. Nobody else would talk to her. They kept saying, come on, you can beat this. And she couldn't. She knew she couldn't. And she needed to tell somebody she was dying and for somebody to validate it and validate her feelings and thoughts and to just talk about it. And I was able to do that. And I realised that I was very comfortable with it and it felt right.
How common is regret amongst the people who are dying?
Very common. Why didn't I do this earlier? I've often heard people say, we kept saying we'll do this when I retire. Well, I've just retired and now I'm dying. Or I work so hard and I miss the children growing up. Why did I worry about other people's opinions of me? Why didn't I just go for it? Why didn't I become the nurse I wanted to be? Because somebody told me I wasn't good enough. I am good enough, but it's too late. It's your own mind telling you that other people don't think you're good enough to do something or you've got plenty of time to do it in the future. So how I live my life now is if there's an opportunity, I think, yeah, let's go for it, let's do it. Because you never know what's around the corner.
Do you ever attend a death when the person is on their own because there aren't family members or friends around?
Yes, I've been with somebody who's got nobody about and you can just sit there and be quiet with them, really. You know, they don't need a running commentary. People who are dying really need to concentrate on dying in a way. Sometimes I use a recording of the sea because the waves are in and out and it's quite rhythmic and it's a bit like breathing, really.
Have you worked with anyone who has got family and friends but actually wants to die alone regardless?
I think you should honour it. If that's what somebody wants. And that's when you talk to the families and say, you know, this is what they want. So I've been with lots of people who have sat with their family for a day, 2 days, nonstop. And they just say to them, I'm just popping out to get a drink. And the minute they pop out, they die.
Why is that?
Lots of people are very self-conscious. It could be that they don't want to be watched dying. It could be that they're trying to protect their loved ones from seeing the actual death. It happens an awful lot. And it's something, if that's happened to you, don't feel guilty that you missed it. It's perfectly normal for that to happen. They're doing it when they want. People die how they lived. So if they were a very calm person while they're alive, they're probably going to be very calm when they die. If they're quite a hothead and a grumpy, they'll probably be hot-headed and grumpy on their way to dying. People don't suddenly change because they're dying.
Do you think some families, though, want their family member to die in hospital because the responsibility of having them at home feels too daunting?
It is daunting. It is. I'm not going to say, oh, no, it's fine. It's not. It's really hard. Having somebody dying at home is hard. It's lonely. It's the responsibility of it all is huge. Yeah, you've got to be informed and know what you're doing or what's likely to happen.
But I can imagine there might be occasions where somebody's explicit wish is, I want to die at home, because that sounds so nice. And the person who has to do the caring for them may not feel comfortable doing that. Does that ever happen in your experience?
Yeah, that happens quite regularly. So that would be a conversation that we would have. Maybe I might have it on a one-to-one with the person who's dying first and explain that, you know, it's quite hard for the person that's there with to deal with it. And how would they feel about perhaps going to a hospice, or whether we can get a live-in carer to come in and help, or whether they're okay with just having an end-of-life doula there. And then I'd bring in the other person, and then we would try and bridge and come to some sort of happy medium that they're all, you know, they're okay with.
Tell me, what happens when people die? Are there any common themes that you've observed?
Yeah, people start talking in a different language. So you'll hear somebody say things like, where are my shoes? I need my shoes. Do you know where my suitcase is? Have you got the tickets? Have the tickets arrived yet? So it's all about travel, all about moving on. And so if I'm with a family and they're like, what is he on about? Why does he need a train ticket? I would say to them, go with it. Just tell them that you're arranging it. It's coming. It's here. Because they are going on a journey. We don't know where they're going. I don't know where they're going. But they're going on it. And it's a real common theme.
You're in a position where you see things happen again and again. And what we might see as being idiosyncratic to the person that we love actually is quite common. Mm. Are there any other examples that you can think of that you recognise we're at this stage again?
Yep. So people pick, we call it picking, so with their fingers. So it'd be the thumb and the finger, and they'll be picking at the clothes. And people think they're agitated, and it's actually just a normal sign of things slowing down and towards death. Or sometimes they'll be reaching out in front of them. Their hands seem to go up in the air. And it's just one of those things that it frequently happens. It's, yeah. So when it happens, you can say to people, do you know what? That's normal. That's okay. We're expecting that. And I think the biggest one is the death rattle, that everybody seems to go, you know, you hear that, you're a goner. Yes, you are dying with it. But it's not hurting them. It sometimes it can be quite daunting when you hear it. But if you actually watch the person, they are unconscious. And that bubbling noise is just mucus or a little bit of saliva just stuck in the back of the throat. And because they're not swallowing, it's just sitting there. So the air is just bubbling through it. When you can explain that to somebody, it's a lot easier. And you can say, look, you know, they're perfectly calm. It's not hurting them. They're not distressed. Maybe if we just turn them slightly, that might ease it.
What has this job taught you about death?
Life is very fragile, and that at any moment it can change for all of you. To tell your family that you love them, to have those conversations with your family about what you want, what you don't want. Yeah, I could honestly say that when my husband went in for an operation last year, if anything had gone wrong, we had said everything we needed to say to each other beforehand. So I knew that we'd have no regrets if anything happened.
How does he find the role that you have?
He's got used to it now. He always says, I could never do it. He's very proud of what I do. He can now say the word hospice, which he couldn't say many years ago. He has got used to death and dying being all over my desk at home.
I so relate to that.
Books galore. And then he'll come in and I'm watching a YouTube video of somebody carrying out a post-mortem or something like that. And it's like, oh, you could have warned me.
Well, my husband says, God, if anyone broke into our house, they'd think you were a serial killer with a penchant for interior design. You know, it's so true. But I think it raises an interesting issue. What impact do you think the media has on the way we think about dying?
The media has a lot to answer for, really, on death and dying, because they glamorise it into something it's not.
Give me an example.
So when they're providing CPR on somebody that, you know, 10 minutes later, they're sitting up having a chat with their family and having a cup of tea. It doesn't work like that. It's brutal, CPR. Certainly for those that are dying anyway, what's likely to happen once they've had it? You know, they're not going to be bouncing straight up, sitting there having a cup of tea. They're actually going to be quite poorly. They may well have their ribs broken. They may well have a tube down their throat helping them breathe. They may have loads of intravenous lines in their hands. They've suddenly become a medical problem.
What happens when you've had a death that's really affected you? How do you bring yourself back to yourself?
Okay, so when you've left the family, you normally get in the car, you drive around the corner, and then you let it go. And you can cry and really let that hurt and emotion out. You've got to let it out. Then you go home, and then you take all your clothes off. You get in the shower and you wash it away. And then I will sit down and write reflections of the day, of what's gone on, what's happened, how I'm feeling. And then I won't do it straight away, but maybe a day or two later, I will speak to a mentor and then talk to them and say, hey, this one's really affected me. I need to talk about it.
Can I ask you a personal question? When you've gone back to your mentor about the ones that have hit you particularly hard, what is it that has hurt?
It is when you could see yourself in that same situation. So it could be a young person that's the same age as yourself. It could be that they've lost a child. It could be that that person actually reminds you of somebody that you've lost. You might have had a really long relationship with that person and without realizing it, become really quite fond of them. And then, you have to be really careful and you have to download this to your mentor and really talk it out.
Tell me about the death that's taught you the most.
That would be somebody who was quite young, who had a young family, who was going through mental hell, I'd say, that it had happened to him. Why him? But he kept a lot of anger. He tried to be very brave with it and he wasn't letting go. And his wife said to me once, can you please try and help him go? And so we had a really long heart-to-heart with it. I eventually got him to let go and tell me what his real fears were.
Can I ask you what that fear was without compromising that person's confidentiality?
It was leaving his child behind without a father figure and that he had failed as a father for leaving him.
Last year, I know your mother died and you were a doula for her. Tell me about that experience.
I'd actually come back from doing a piece of training and I was on a real high. My sister rang me and she said, there's something wrong with Mum. So I rang her and I said, what's going on? And then it started to come out that actually she'd had a scan and that there was a growth. And so straight into doula mode. Okay, so I went over and saw her. And then it's just the enormity of it all, of realising that actually the person that you thought would be there for years to come is suddenly dying. And now I'm on the other side of it. So it was a real experience. And she taught me so much through it, how she felt, how other people were treating her, what medical things she did or didn't want. And I was able to go with her and journey with her.
How did you balance the role as a doula and as a daughter?
It was a learning curve. I'm not going to say I did it perfectly because I probably didn't. But I said to her that, you know, I'm trying to be both here and it's difficult. I was open and honest with her with it. And she was very honest as well. So it worked really well. It was one of the best experiences because she taught me so much. She loved the fact that I was an end-of-life doula. Loved it.
What are the biggest challenges to you of this role?
You get one chance to get it right. So it's not like you can let somebody die and say, oh, I really cocked that up. Can we just do that bit again? It's too late. So you've got to be on the ball. You've got to be grounded at all times. So, you know, whatever's happening in your own life, you've got to park that.
What happens when you bring your doula feelings back into your family? How do you park the doula bit?
I have a doula bag. So when I pick the doula bag up, I am the doula. It's really weird. And so when I come home, that bag goes back to where the doula bag lives. And the clothes I wear being a doula go out. So I don't wear them normally. So I go back to being mum role. And then I pick my bag up, I'm doula role.
How do your children react to what you do?
Well, they were sort of mid-teenagers when I started doing it. And they're really good, actually, now. They just accept it. It's becoming normal for them, which I'm really pleased about, because when my mother did die, they were there and they were able to cope with it and able to sit with her, which, had I have not had this role, I don't think they would have done. I would have tried to probably protect them and said, no, you don't need to see her or you don't need to do anything. Whereas I was very open. If you would like to come, you are very welcome. And if you don't want to, that's fine too.
Tell me about how you would like to die.
I would like to die at home, as long as my family are happy. It depends on how far away it is. But if it was happening now, although I would like to die at home, I'm very conscious of my children, our early 20s, and the impact it would have on them of me dying at home. So I would want to talk to them, how comfortable they are with it. If they're not, I think I would probably want to go to a hospice.
And who will you want with you?
I would like my husband there. I would like my children if they can cope with it. And I would like my pets.
We often take for granted we know what our partners want in long-term relationships. And how accurate is that? Because in my experience, when I've talked to friends, deeply close friends, about their wishes, I've got it really wrong. And I'm curious about that. Is that quite common?
It's very common. We sort of tend to think, oh, well, they're like me. You know, we lived together for 40 years. We think the same. Well, actually, you don't. And so it's very important that we get this out before things get too far down the line. So it's much harder to talk to somebody if they're in the last week of dying than it is 6 months before.
You strike me as having two quite distinct roles, and I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. You're the person that we should call when we want to do our planning, mm-hmm. like we would a solicitor about our will, mm-hmm. and that can happen now.
Yeah.
And then you're the person who comes and helps towards the end.
Yeah, so I would be quite comfortable going to see somebody who's in their 20s, 30s, 40s, who's fit as a fiddle, to help them plan and say, yep, cheerio, hope I don't see you for a very long time. And others, we might do their plan and I might see them in a year or two. End-of-life doulas don't sort of say, that's my job, I've finished, I'm out of here. We're not like that at all. We can carry on for a long time with it and that. So it's a bit like when somebody dies. We don't just stop the minute somebody dies. We'll stay with a family for however long they need and that, but not so long that they become dependent on you.
How do you manage that? Because I can imagine you are a very comforting mm-hmm. presence and you are also a link to the person who's died. How do you extricate yourself?
Yeah, it's tough. It is hard. So when you first go in and meet the family, you make it quite clear that this is your role and that you will be there afterwards, but there will be a time when you won't be. When you get to the other side, it may be that you say, right, okay, I think our time together is coming to an end. Let's meet up and go through it and just talk.
Do you ever have clients who come to the end of their life and just say, that was a great one, I'm okay with where I am and I'm happy to go forward?
Yes, and it's lovely, really lovely when you get a client like that, because you can really work with them. You can really have a really honest, really chunky conversation about death and dying, and you can ask them all sorts of things and get really good answers back. And you're not, yeah, you can just sort of say, hey, where are you going? What do you think is going to happen when you get there? It's a really lovely, lovely to be able to do that.
And is that an uplifting death for you?
Yeah, because they're teaching you all the time. Or every death that I witness, that I'm with the family all the way along, I'm learning.
So, Lizzie, what is a good death?
So a good death to me is that you are in the place that you want to be, that you have the people that you want around you, that you have said what you needed to say. And that's really important, is that people talk to one another before they get to that end stage. And to say, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I forgive you, I love you, and thank you.
They're such simple phrases. I think probably for a lot of people, they think, have I had that conversation with a parent? And actually, you're making it sound very manageable.
Mm. We try and keep things as simple as possible.
So I'm going to ask you, what has this job taught you about living?
Go for it. Everything, go for it. If there's an opportunity, even if it's really scary, do it. And you'll learn along the way. I'm forever out of my comfort zone now. Yeah, I get really scared, but it's like, woo, it's a ride and you've got to go for it.
My thanks to Lizzie Neville for being so open and honest. And if someone close to you is dying and you think, gosh, I could really do with a Lizzie, then contact the organisation that trained her, End of Life Doula UK. Now, they're a wonderful resource and they can put you in touch with someone who can help you in your local area. As ever, I'll put a link to their website on this episode's show notes, which you can find on our website, deadhonest.com. So until next time.